The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I spent $40,000 on shoes.
What's the matter, Morty?
Great gowns, beautiful gowns.
Fashion has changed. No, it hasn't.
Hi, I'm Lauren Garoni.
And I'm Chelsea Fairless. And guys, we're back from the Pacific Northwest.
Yes, we're back from our West Coast tour, although we have two more dates in Los Angeles, but those are hometown shows. So it feels like the last 3 dates that we did, that's the West Coast tour.
Yes, it was so nice seeing all of the Pacific Northwest fuckettes come out. We love you guys.
We specifically didn't get spray tanned as a nod to the Pacific Northwest weather region.
Well, I wanted to, but then you like fucked up your schedule and didn't have time to get one. So I just didn't get one out of solidarity because I didn't want you to look like unnecessarily pale and sallow standing next to me, because that's what a real friend does.
Thank you. I love how fucking up my schedule was being so psychotically busy. I just did not have time to get one.
This tour was great from the beginning because we started our journey in the Burbank Airport, our favorite airport.
For those who don't live in Los Angeles, Burbank is our regional airport, and anytime you get to fly out of it, which is unfortunately quite rare, and, you know, if you're not like Chelsea and don't show up at 4 a.m, which is what happened
the
last time you went to Humboldt, it is the best experience. But I will say this tour has taught me, as, you know, a coastal elite who's only ever flown out of LAX or JFK, that every other airport in the United States is better than those two airports, because I didn't realize this till this tour, but most airports are actually just 20 to 25 minutes away from the city center.
Yeah, but I do think that the Seattle airport has some room for improvement.
Oh, we'll get into that.
Although I should mention one downside of the Burbank airport, they could also be an upside depending on how you look at it, is that you have no choice but to eat Guy Fieri's food. It's the only restaurant, and then in like the little store where you buy magazines and stuff, it's like the only food.
That's true. I don't know why he has such a hold on the Burbank airport. I've not seen it anywhere else. But, you know, if it has to be someone, might as well be Guy Fieri. They also play, on top of his visage being everywhere in the restaurants, they are also playing old episodes of Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives.
I loved when Paul ordered a Bloody Mary and the waitress was like, just so you know, this has pork and beef in it.
Or as I said, hogs and dogs.
So fucked up. Hogs and dogs is what I want to name my future sanctuary for rescued pigs and bulldogs in Topanga Canyon. This is like my 20 years down the line goal, assuming I'll be alive then.
Which may or may not have been lifted from the end of 6 Feet Under.
Maybe a little bit.
So we went to San Francisco a few days early because, as we've learned from the East Coast tour, the only way to actually see a city is to get there a few days before or stay a few days afterwards.
Yes. And it was also special because your parents flew up, my parents flew down, and they went to our show, which was really cute. Also, in the show, we have this bit that's a parody of The Price is Right, where we usually get volunteers from the audience to guess how much, like, insane designer items cost. But this time, we forced our moms to do it. How fun.
Yes, on Father's Day, our gifts to our fathers were to not publicly humiliate them on stage and instead do that to our mothers, which you guys have gotten to know us on this podcast. Please understand, our mothers are the sweetest, nicest, like, shy women possible. And for their love for us knows no bounds so much that they got on stage.
Yeah, they were great. Although your mom really mopped the floor with my mom.
And she was so nervous to play. She was like, your father and I looked up the Price is Right rules before the show.
It's like, oh, we don't really enforce them that strongly.
That segment was the one that went the most off the rails just because we couldn't keep it straight who won each round.
Yeah, we literally, like, couldn't do it in Portland, basically. But anyway, what else? Oh, in San Francisco, we went to the De Young Museum. We saw a really great fashion exhibition called Fashioning San Francisco, which was basically a bunch of pieces from the permanent collection that were donated by philanthropists, socialites from San Francisco.
Right. And the most fun part of the exhibition was the placards that would tell you where these very wealthy women of San Francisco wore these beautiful gowns, where it's like, so-and-so wore this Valentino dress to meet the queen.
Yeah, it was very fab. These San Francisco ladies were turning out some looks. Also, there was a pretty robust avant-garde section. And I never imagined that women in San Francisco were, like, walking around in, like, head-to-toe, like, insane Junya Watanabe ensembles and stuff.
San Francisco before tech took over seems like a very fun place. Wish I could have been there.
But there was also this cool element of the exhibition where you could virtually try on some of the pieces in the show.
Was it cool?
It was cool because they gave you three options. There was, like, a gold brocade Valentino. There was, like, a really wacky ensemble by Kaizik Wong, who's an amazing San Francisco-based designer. And then there was this Dior, very famous Dior gown designed by Yves Saint Laurent. And wow. I just want to say that when I tried that one on, I was like, oh, this is what Divine would have looked like had she been invited to Truman Capote's black and white ball. I looked amazing, but it did add, like, at least 75 pounds.
To help you guys visualize this, the dresses in augmented reality, you look into a mirror and then digitally the dresses are put over your body. And all I can say is augmented reality has a ways to go. And my mom was so excited to do this. I just saw, like, the quiet resignation as we went through each one. And I was like, is everything okay? And she was like, can I see yours? And I was like, sure. And I showed her me in that Dior dress and she went, oh good, you look awful too. It's like, yeah, yeah, don't worry about it. We all look like Fiona from Shrek.
Yeah, that was a little jarring, but major nonetheless. There was also a really amazing Irving Penn show there, FYI, for anyone that lives in San Francisco. Run, don't walk.
And then before we knew it, we were off to Portland.
Yeah, Portland was a blur. We only really had, like, a few hours to walk around and do stuff.
But I feel like we made the most of it.
We did. We went to, what was that place called?
Jake's?
Oh, yeah. We found basically, like, the Musso and Frank of Portland, like this seafood restaurant that's 10,000 years old.
Yeah. And they love to. Was it on the menu or was it a placard that was like, Madonna once ate here?
You know, that's all I need to know. That's all I care about in a restaurant, frankly.
And also the first restaurant I've ever been to that had a menu just dedicated to their different kind of mules.
Oh, yeah. Like Moscow mules.
Yes.
Mean.
It's like, do you want a raspberry mule, a strawberry mule?
I love to have the options. We also went to Powell's, their big bookstore. Powell's makes the Strand look like I don't even fucking know.
Because you know what Strand is missing that Powell's has, other than it takes up a city block, is their sections are colored. It's like, I lost Paul at a certain point. I was like, where are you? He was like, I'm in the blue section.
It's the only way to, like, not get lost in that store.
And you found what seems like a bucket list book for you.
Oh, yeah. I got this amazing book about Eiko Ishioka, the Japanese creative director, costume designer that I've been wanting forever. Has the most like psychotic photo of Faye Dunaway on the cover. Total bucket list book. Also, we went to Frances May, which is like where the girls in Portland get their tabbies and Batsheva dresses.
And sardine candles, which if we had room in our suitcases, we would have bought one.
Yeah, making candles shaped like tin fish is genius. Like, millennials just like can't stop themselves from buying that shit.
No, what we lack in children, we make up for in candles that look like things in our pantry.
So true. And then, yeah, Seattle. We didn't really do anything there except for go to the Nordstrom, which was probably the best thing we could have done because it's the most aspirational Nordstrom I've ever seen.
Well, it's the first Nordstrom. Nordstrom is headquartered in Seattle, and we were very tempted to go to the Nordstrom Rack instead, but we decided
we should have gone to the Nordstrom Rack. We could have scored some deals.
We soldiered on and went to the Nordstrom, and Chelsea, just like a mantra, was like, I hope they have a space. I hope they have a space. Lauren, what if they don't have a Nordstrom space?
Hashtag not all Nordstroms have a Nordstrom space. And by space, I'm talking about the section of Nordstrom that is dedicated to avant-garde and emerging designers that some Nordstroms have.
While they did not have a Nordstrom space, it was because the entire Nordstrom was dedicated to avant-garde designers.
Well, yes, they did have a Nordstrom space, but it was like the most high-end Nordstrom space I've ever seen.
Yeah. And I will say another thing that has happened on this tour is I feel like our friendship has really shifted into another gear and we're better for it. And it's the fact that I've just let Chelsea start styling me now. Like, I'm her own little personal doll. Like, all the outfits that I wore on this tour were styled by Chelsea.
Look, I just wanted to make sure that we didn't look crazy together and that our outfits didn't clash. Like, it's not like we need to match per se, but there needs to be some degree of harmony.
Right. That was the entry level thing. And then since the tour started, now I get curated picks from Chelsea. And then we ironically rarely ever shop together. Like, why would we here in LA? When we were at the Nordstrom, was the first time you were ever like, okay, you're going to buy this. And it was a Vaquera. It was two Vaquera pieces on sale.
Yeah, deeply discounted.
I see your eyes. We are recording. We're back in my closet recording because this is the best place for sound. And I see your eyes darting around seeing if the Vaquera skirt is here. It's not in this room right now.
Well, it's beautiful and I can't wait to see you wear it.
It's a fairly conservative to the knee skirt, but it then has a pink thong on either side of it.
Yes, it's poor man Schiaparelli, but so fab.
I think we had one of our best shows in Seattle. We played the Triple Door, which it's funny. Every venue is different and special in its own ways. Like in Portland, we played an honest to goodness comedy club, which had never happened before. And then the Triple Door was a jazz club that had this like tiered row seating and booths that were very cool.
Yeah, that was a good one.
So you went home the next day. I stayed because my soon to be sister-in-law lives there. So I stayed an extra day. We took the same flight home, but your experience was very different than mine because when I attempted to go home, my flight was so delayed that it then got canceled. I had to wait 2 hours to get my luggage back. And then when I attempted to take the flight the next day, I'm at that stage of aging where I coughed and I threw my back out.
Okay, but you're not at that stage of aging, though.
When I was a teenager, into my early 20s, I like threw my back out 3 separate times, and it has not happened in 15 years.
I'm so sorry. So have you been like hobbling around and stuff? You seem fine now.
Thank you. I mean, if you'll notice, there's a gigantic pillow behind me in this chair to support my back.
Oh, I was wondering why I didn't get one of those.
Would you like one?
I mean, it's fine. I'm fine for now.
But we need to talk about the Seattle airport, SeaTac.
Oh no, it's horrible. Horrible place. Don't go there.
So during one of the delays, they were like, oh, we've changed your gate. Now you need to go to C10. And it's like, okay, that's not a gate change. We're switching terminals. I now have to get on a train.
That's like I'm going to a different state.
I don't know why they keep being like, oh, you're in gate N. It's like, that's a different if I need to take transportation to get there, that's not changing gates. That's a different terminal, okay?
Well, I'm glad you made it, babe.
I'm glad my luggage made it.
Yeah, it would be so sad if you had lost your new Vaquera pieces in the shuffle. That's... Not to mention all of those outfits I generously styled for you.
All right, enough about this. Let's get to Hot Topics.
Yeah, let's talk about Justin Timberlake's DUI.
Yeah, sorry we're getting to this a week late, but we must discuss. So last Tuesday, news broke that Justin Timberlake had been arrested for driving while intoxicated in the Hamptons. I don't know about you, Chell, but when I woke up and saw this, I swore he committed vehicular manslaughter because the way that this story was being presented was as if he had killed someone. And it's like drunk driving ranks two on the thing, like the scandalous things that celebrities do besides cheating on their wives. Like, it's, I'm not saying drunk driving is cool, but it's fairly commonplace.
No, drunk driving is definitely not cool, which is why I found it weird that everyone seemed to be so gleeful about this. Like, I get that everyone has just read Britney's book. I still haven't. I'm sorry, I can't, don't hate me. But I don't know if we should be celebrating and reframing this as karma or something.
As opposed to questioning why he doesn't just have a driver?
Well, that's the thing that doesn't make sense. Although, look, who knows if this is true. Justin claims that he had one martini at the restaurant. The bartender did corroborate that. He, of course, could have been drinking before he got to the restaurant, so that doesn't really mean much. But if he did, in fact, have one martini and get a DUI, then I genuinely feel bad for him.
Right. So... the other thing that's gone viral beyond the fact that he was arrested for drunk driving is the arresting officer was so young that he did not know who Justin Timberlake was, and this alleged exchange has now become a meme where allegedly Justin Timberlake said, oh man, this is going to ruin the tour, and the officer said, what tour? And he replied back, the world tour. In a subsequent New York Post article, it was revealed who the arresting officer was. I don't want to say his name because I don't want to dox him. Evidently, he has been a main source of annoyance for the wealthy in the Hamptons, who have dubbed him the Sag Harbor Nazi and Little Red-Headed Dipshit for his strict enforcement of traffic laws, which begs the question, ACAB, but like maybe let this cop giving Rich Hampton's local shit slide? Like, I don't know. I'm of two minds.
I don't know. I don't think you should be able to like run a stop sign, but I think there's a fine line. Sometimes a tap is acceptable, especially if no one else is on the road.
A tap on the brake. You mean a Cher Horowitz, I totally paused.
I don't believe in traffic enforcement being like enforced too heavily. You know what I mean? Obviously, if someone is driving dangerously, that's a different issue entirely. That's why the traffic police exists. Wait, what are they called? The highway patrol?
Yeah, I mean, the highway patrol is for the highway. These are the, I mean, I have never been to the Hamptons, but I imagine the quiet suburban streets of Long Island. For us, this made us realize that Justin Timberlake is evidently on a world tour. He was 3 days away from launching his first date in Chicago.
Yeah, this was actually like genius publicity for the tour.
What tour?
The world tour, Lauren.
So his first date on the world tour was in Chicago 3 days after his arrest. He did acknowledge the arrest without actually saying anything. He said, we've been through ups and downs and lefts and rights. It's been a tough week. I know sometimes I'm hard to love, but you keep on loving me and I'm going to love you right back.
I don't know. It scares me that that cop doesn't know who Justin Timberlake is. Like, does he only know who Harry Styles is?
Or Justin Bieber?
Yeah, you skipped that generation entirely. Like, you're not even aware of it. You don't even recognize his name. His face, sure, but like,
I mean, maybe he was like, hey, your voice sounds familiar. Are you the one that voiced one of the characters in the Trolls movie?
Wait, did he actually voice a character in the Trolls movie, or did he just do that like song with the dancing trolls?
I thought he did a voice in Trolls. Hold on one second. Yes, he was the voice of Branch.
You act as if I know who Branch the Troll is.
Not to be confused with Anna Kendrick, who voiced Poppy, Zooey Deschanel, who voiced Bridget, ooh, Christine Baranski, who voiced Chef. Wait, Gwen Stefani did a voice for the Trolls film?
Wow. This cop doesn't know who any of those people are, apparently.
We discussed this during our Seattle show. This was before he made a statement at his concert, but we thought that he should go the Reese Witherspoon apology route, which was essentially like, I'm an idiot.
Yeah, I'm a piece of shit. Not that Reese Witherspoon got a DUI herself, but her husband did, and then she got into a drunken, do you know who I am, altercation with the arresting officer.
I actually went back because I was like, what was her statement? And it was this. I clearly had one drink too many, and I'm deeply embarrassed about the things I said.
Wait, doesn't she have a book called Whiskey in a Teacup? Did she have too much whiskey in that teacup that night?
I think so. Oh my God. I had no idea. Wait, she...
I actually saw it at Powell's, which is what just made me think of it.
Whiskey in a teacup, what growing up in the South taught me about life, love, and baking biscuits. Has anyone read this book? Does she reference her arrest?
I kind of love the fact that she just has these drunk moments, like when she was papped falling down the stairs at Sunset Tower after Jennifer Aniston's birthday party.
That's right. For the Patreon fuckettes, we always send out a postcard with a paparazzi photo. And we almost used that one, but I was like, it's too obscure.
Well, because you can't see her face. It's like you have to see the photos of her coming out. Like, it is just a blur. It looks like a Francis Bacon painting or something. Very abstract.
You know what? Now that we've said it on the podcast, I feel like we should use it.
Okay, what else happened?
Right before we left for tour, it was announced that a Practical Magic sequel would be happening.
Goddess bless. Our prayers have been answered. Actually, Lauren, did you know that when I was a little girl, I cast a spell wishing for a Practical Magic sequel and also a guy with one green eye and one blue eye? And I guess one of those things came true.
There's still time. Well, the rollout of this news was kind of bizarre. I don't know if you saw this, but Max teased an impending announcement on June 9th at midnight, only for them to be like, oh, the film's available to stream at midnight. So obviously fans were like, oh, this was a bait and switch. This sucks. Yet again, fuck Max. Except not us. We love you, Max.
Love Max.
But then people broke the news that Sandra Bullock and Nicole Kidman were in talks to confirm. And then a week later, Nicole Kidman at the premiere of A Family Affair confirmed the news by saying, yes, I will be in it and Sandy will be in it. And that's that.
And I will be in a strawberry blonde wig, TBD.
Like with the Justin Timberlake arrest, I am of two minds about this because at once, I think I've been on record saying all millennial women want is a Practical Magic cinematic universe, but also, this does speak to the creatively bankrupt period we seem to be in Hollywood, where it's easier to greenlight sequels and prequels than original content.
Yeah, but if there was like a 10-hour version of Practical Magic, I would watch it. I want as much Practical Magic as I can get. I don't care if the quality is diluted a little bit. And honestly, I wish they would go the Yellowstone route, because I want to see like films about the Owens family dating back to the Salem witch trials. I want the origin story for Stalker Channing and Diane Wiest's characters.
Well, Chelsea, I have great news for you, because did you know Practical Magic was based on a book?
I did know that.
By a woman named Alice Hoffman, who, after the film's release, has gone on to write two prequels and a sequel. So there's a prequel called Rules of Magic, which does get into Stalker Channing and Diane Wiest's childhood, being raised in New York City in the 1960s.
Oh, what a dream.
And there is a sequel called The Book of Magic that brings together the three Owens generations that we care about, and seems to be Kylie, that was played by Evan Rachel Wood in the Practical Magic film. It seems to be centered on her story.
Great. I'm so down for all of this. I'm curious where these women are at in their lives, though. Like, I hope Nicole Kidman is still, like, wearing sarongs and doing, like, slutty dances by the pool and, like, flirting with guys, you know? And I hope that Sandra Bullock's character's skincare line has taken off in the intervening years.
Oh, right. That was my joke during the live shows, because we talked about this, is that I hope that there's a crossover storyline with Goop and Gwyneth Paltrow enters the film, but as herself.
Yeah, I would love that. I would also love if Sandra Bullock's skincare line had like vending machines at the airport like Kylie Jenner.
Has anyone gotten anything out of that Kylie Jenner airport vending machine?
It's so wild. It's like it used to be just Benefit Cosmetics that had those vending machines at airports. And then at some point, like, they all disappeared and were replaced with Kylie Jenner.
It's funny, too, because when I'm at the airport and realize that I've forgotten something, it's rarely my Benetint. It's more like a toothbrush.
God, I haven't used Benetint in so long, because it basically like tattoos your face.
Tattoos your face red. Yes, it's like before Glossier, there was Benetint.
Benetint, like, it could take days to get that off, though, you know?
You just have a ruddy complexion.
Okay, moving on to another important thing that has happened, the music event of the year. I am, of course, referring to the Girl So Confusing Version with Lorde, Charlie XCX's latest single.
Yeah, between the What Tour, the World Tour, and Let's Work It Out on the Remix, it has been an incredible week for memes.
Absolutely. When I first heard this song, I cried. I didn't just tear up. I had like a cathartic sob, which really speaks to Charlie and Lorde's power and perhaps my own precarious mental health.
I was going to ask how you first experienced this, because for me, it was seeing the Charlie XCX Instagram post where it was Lorde seemingly texting Charlie her entire verse and Charlie just texting back, fucking hell.
No, I knew when it was being released. I was like, oh, I have to listen to this immediately. I listened to that at 9 p.m. Pacific time on the dot.
So how do we want to do this? Do we want to go through it lyric by lyric? Because I can.
No, I think everyone's heard it. And if you haven't heard it, just stop the podcast right now and listen to it because it's amazing.
And we would drop a clip here, but we don't want to get copyright claimed.
Well, also, it's like you kind of can't really even clip out a part of Lorde's verse. It's like you need the entire thing.
It's a fascinating piece of art, pop music, and pop culture that I feel like everyone collectively participated in, because it's like Charlie made the song, we metabolized it, and we're like, oh, this is clearly about Lorde. And then Lorde responded in a way that not only healed their friendship, but it also soothed many women like ourselves about our own female friendships.
Absolutely. Because I completely understand what it's like to be the Charlie in this situation, as well as the Lorde in this situation.
Right. I mean, we talked about this song a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, but for those who maybe need a refresher, it's basically Charlie writing about a friend who's like, I don't think we're frenemies, but I don't think this person fucks with me, so therefore, like, I don't really care for her. And then in Lorde's verse on this remix, you see her side of the story, where basically she was like, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't want to be in photos, not because I didn't fuck with you, but, like, I'm having a lot of body dysmorphia issues.
Yeah, and I'm clearly just, like, depressed and fucked up.
The lyric that got me, that took me out, was, she believed my projection, and now I totally get it. And I was like, yeah.
Totally. I met one of my best friends at a dinner party during the pandemic, and it was like the first time that I'd been in a social situation with people that I didn't know in like 6 months, 8 months, something like that. It was a bunch of fashion people. I'd gained weight. I was growing out my hair. I felt so insecure. And I met this girl who I'm now close with, and she was like, I thought you fucking hated me. I was like, what did I do to this bitch? Was my first thought when I met you. And I was like, oh, I completely get that. I'm glad she was able to look past the first impression. But I've also been on the Charlie side of it too, where it's like I've run into girls that I've felt so dismissed by or shaded by for whatever reason that it then turns out that they actually do like me.
Right, and just are going through something that has nothing. I mean, we all have the inclination to individualize things, where instead of just being like, oh, maybe this person's going through something, it's like, what did I do to them?
For sure. It also like really tripped me up when I started meeting people that worked in the fashion industry, because it can actually be hard to tell like who's a bitch and who is just like very, very insecure or awkward.
Right.
Just because someone like looks cool doesn't necessarily mean that they feel comfortable. They might even be intimidated by you. You know, you just don't know.
Well, as someone who has semi-recently gone through a falling out with a friend that I was not even aware I was falling out with, I did find this song just a fascinating meditation on female friendship, because I think we can all relate to a friendship falling out for reasons that no one can quite explain. And beyond texting like, hey, what the fuck happened? There's no resolution. And like, none of us have the medium of like a zeitgeisty summer album to work it out on.
Yeah. I think it's also just beyond the lyrics and how amazing they are and how honest they are, it's just so refreshing to hear Lorde on a song that is upbeat.
Right.
You know, like it's been a really, really long time. And it's very cool that she molded herself to fit the style of this album, the vibe of this album, so seamlessly.
New era for Lorde, perhaps?
I have never stand Lorde harder in my life than I do right now at this particular moment. And I'm a fan of hers. I wasn't the biggest
solar power
girly, but loved the previous records. And another thing that's so great about this song that I think really resonated with people, it's like, it's a song that's not about falling in love, breaking up, and cheating. Like, why are all songs about this shit? Why can't we have songs about body dysmorphia, female friendship, like common things?
Yeah, or like, it reminds me of when I was reading a review for The Substance, our upcoming new favorite film. They were discussing how the film deals with female self-hatred, and I was like, wow, yeah, how has that kind of never been dealt with in film before?
It's definitely been touched upon in our favorite genre of film, glamorous women having nervous breakdowns, but I don't know if people are really talking about that in a contemporary way. And even in music, it's like, there's only so many songs that really address this, my favorite being Unpretty by TLC.
Yes.
We also got Pretty Hurts by Beyonce. I think what else? But this one feels like the realest.
Yeah, basically being like, I'm sorry you didn't think we were friends or you thought I was an asshole. I thought you had all of your shit together while I was falling apart.
Yeah.
But we're both fucked up.
But we're still friends, which brings a new element to the sort of friendship banger genre, of which there aren't even that many of those, you know? Like, when I think about songs about female friendship, I immediately think about Count On Me, the Whitney Houston and CeCe Winans duet from the Waiting to Exhale soundtrack, the greatest soundtrack of all time, in my opinion.
And a great film about female friendship.
Absolutely.
When I was trying to think about other female friendship songs, I drew a blank. I was like, I got nothing?
Yeah, it's like the Golden Girls theme song, which is amazing, for sure. But like, the fact that that's where my mind goes.
Well, also because in recent years, female friendship as entertainment has been shown through the Real Housewives franchise, which is not a great example of female friendship. Entertaining, yes.
Yeah, I wish people would write more songs like this. God willing.
Well, maybe they've started a new genre.
It feels like this did signal some sort of shift. I think people are sick of manufactured pop music right now that doesn't feel honest, with lyrics that people would never actually like say to another person in real life.
I don't know. Only time will tell. Wait, have we gotten our Charlie XCX Troye Sivan tickets yet?
No, but we can discuss after the app.
What else? So while we were on tour, we both read Kathleen Hanna's memoir, Rebel Girl. What qualifies as an autobiography versus memoir?
I think memoirs are like if your life is fucked up.
Well,
yeah, this is, unfortunately, this book is a fascinating read, but it is very, very upsetting. Also, I suppose we should say, if you don't know who Kathleen Hanna is, she is the lead singer of Bikini Kill. She is the lead singer of La Tigra and the most famous Riot Girl, much to her dismay.
Indeed. And we were very excited to read this book. I mean, she does warn us in the preface of this book of like, I don't know how to write about my life because I don't want it to all be about the sexual assault. And I was like, that's interesting. And then you read the book and you're like, oh my God.
Yeah, it's what she had to experience is so, so deeply fucked up. So yes, it's a great read. I did enjoy this book, but it was quite upsetting.
So we're not going to discuss those parts of the book, but we thought it might be fun to discuss the fun parts of the book. The most interesting parts of the book.
I don't know about the most interesting, but like the least likely to trigger someone listening to the podcast right now.
Fair enough. All right, where should we start? Maybe the origins of Bikini Kill?
Sure. So basically, Kathleen has this fucked up childhood.
Peppered with a love of musical theater, which basically saves her life.
Yes. She ends up going to art school. She starts her career as a rape crisis counselor, which I didn't realize the extent of that kind of work that she was doing unofficially throughout her entire life.
For decades, really.
She starts making art. She starts making zines. She is in the punk rock scene. She meets a lot of other female punks. The Riot Girl scene is formed, and then she starts Bikini Kill.
Well, she is given the idea to start a band from the author Kathy Acker, who she goes to a seminar with her. And Kathy Acker is basically like, you're not a writer, so like, what's the whole thing? And Kathleen Hanna's like, oh, I do spoken word. And she's like, oh, no one's going to listen to spoken word. Like, when spoken word happens, people just go outside to smoke. So if you really want to capture people's attention, you should start a band.
Great advice by Mother Kathy Acker. But then when Bikini Kill has a bit of a following and Kathy Acker later comes to one of their shows, she's like completely forgotten that she advised this woman to start a band. She's like, oh, I said that? So Kathy Acker, unofficially the mother of Riot Girl, I mean, so many of the themes in her books ended up carrying through.
Absolutely. And also what I thought was refreshing about this book was there's so much history and anecdotes that weren't in the documentary about Kathleen Hanna that came out like 10 years ago, the punk singer.
Okay, but it's weird that the fact that that documentary happened isn't mentioned in this book at all, especially because that came at the point like post La Tigra where she kind of like fell off the face of the earth for like a decade
due to her chronic Lyme, a person who actually does have chronic Lyme disease.
Yeah. What else should we talk about? I guess the Kurt Cobain of it all. Apart from sexual assault, another big through line in this book is Kurt Cobain and the success of Nirvana.
Yes, who Kathleen Hanna was very good friends with. And Kathleen Hanna is the one that gave Kurt the line, "Smells like teen spirit," because when they were staying at the same place, she was writing on his wall and said, "Kurt smells like teen spirit," because Kathleen Hanna and her friend, it's Toby, right?
Toby Vale, yes, the drummer from Bikini Kill, was also dating Kurt Cobain.
Right. They were at a department store earlier that day and saw, or a drugstore earlier that day and saw a deodorant that said teen spirit. And what does that even mean?
Do they still make teen spirit?
There's no way.
I remember seeing it when I was a kid.
And also Kurt sort of pays them back by asking them to be cheerleaders in the Smells Like Teen Spirit video, to which Kathleen Hanna was like, no. And I thought it was very funny in her book. She's like, but then I thought, wait, maybe that's a good thing. And then she was like, no, my first instinct was correct.
Well, also Kurt and Kathleen had some like Charlie Lord moments over the course of their friendship. Like he was pissed that she bought him a copy of the Scum Manifesto because like he thought she was being condescending and like trying to like educate him or whatever. And then she was annoyed with the Nirvana song Rape Me, rightly so. But it was really fascinating to read about their relationship. And, you know, obviously she was a mess when he died. And then to add insult to injury, our girl gets punched in the face by Courtney Love.
Yeah. As a Courtney Love fan, this is a tough read. So,
yeah.
Kathleen Hanna writes about an incident where Courtney,
a famous incident at Lollapalooza.
Right. Courtney Love cold cocks her because she's pretending to pick up a sweater and just like punches her in the face. And earlier that day,
after having never met her, I think is important context here.
Right. Courtney had been talking shit about Kathleen Hanna and Bikini Kill for a while.
In the press, not just like on the low.
Yeah, that was surprising that Kathleen Hanna had actually never met Courtney Love until this incident, so much so that Kathleen Hanna was like, okay, I'm going to prepare a statement if she like begins yelling at me or something, which was, I'll debate you at a college of your choice. And so after Courtney Love punches her, Kathleen Hanna shouts that to her, to which Courtney yells back, "You can't even read. I'm way more feminist than you are."
Okay, I think we should mention that Courtney was also, like, clearly, like, fucked up or on some sort of controlled substance. Not that that's excusing her behavior at all. I'm completely on Kathleen Hanna's side of this. And, yeah, it's upsetting as a Courtney Love fan that she is like this because Kim Gordon from Sonic Youth, who's also mentioned in this book, also hates her. So it's like, I trust Kim and Kathleen more than I trust Courtney.
Yeah. And Kathleen Hanna goes on to press assault charges against Courtney because Courtney had assaulted a different singer who didn't have the means that Kathleen Hanna had at the time, which Kathleen Hanna didn't even really have the means.
No.
But she was more in a position to hold Courtney Love accountable. And in the book, she says, I think she ultimately had to do anger aromatherapy, meaning that nothing of consequence really came out of this.
I thought it was fascinating reading about the fact that Kathleen was apprehensive to be in that Sonic Youth video, the video for Bull in the Heather, because she thought that everyone would call her a sellout. And it's like, I can't believe there was a time when everyone's like anti-corporate ethics were so stringent that like being in a Sonic Youth video would be considered selling out. Like, that's insane.
But, you know, $500 is $500.
And thank God she did. That's an amazing video. Which was also kind of Kim Gordon's Riot Girl moment, because I remember that she was dressed like the titular character of the fucked up movie Baby Doll from the 50s about a teenage girl that sleeps in a crib waiting until her 18th birthday when her husband can finally de-virginize her.
What?
Yeah, it's like a Tennessee Williams. Have you never like...
Oh, yeah. Yes. With Eli Wallach is the guy, right?
I forget who the guy is, but yes, in the Bull and the Heather video, Kim Gordon basically like copies that. The Baby Doll's sad living arrangements.
Another anecdote that I love from this book is Kathleen Hanna watching an episode of Roseanne where they parody a Riot Girl played by Jenna Elfman.
So good. That's the most iconic episode of Roseanne. Although, as Kathleen mentions, it is sad that they dropped the ball on the styling of the character, because they dressed her in a generic like grunge outfit and not in an actual Riot Girl outfit, which was more about like kind of like dressing like a punk version of a little girl with the baby barrettes and the pleated schoolgirl skirts and stuff.
Although she did commend that Aunt Jackie did have the correct dialogue about a Riot Girl.
Absolutely. Well, the discussion of like the bands and stuff was correct, but not the look, unfortunately. And the look was so good.
Another part of the book that I found interesting, especially as like a juxtaposition to the punk singer documentary, is her telling of falling in love with Ad Rock or Adam Horowitz from the Beastie Boys. Again, it's been a long time since I watched the punk singer documentary, but my memory of that is like other people commenting about how they couldn't believe that these two were dating and how that Kathleen was also selling out because she was dating the guy from the Beastie Boys.
Which is so stupid, as if this bitch has to prove anything to anyone. Like, one thing that this book makes very clear is like Bikini Kill never made any money. Like, at the height of their popularity, they weren't even staying in hotels. They were like crashing on people's floors. They weren't making money. They didn't have security at their shows, so they were dealing with like all of these fucked up like violent guys and shit all the time. Like, it was very fucked up and dark. And so I'm fucking glad that she married a Beastie Boy and like has a bit of financial security for once in her life.
Well, that's the other sad thing in the book. There's something about, as two people that like Kathleen Hanna, is she's a very mysterious figure, because only in the book do you find out that, yes, she did marry Adam Horowitz, but it's only because her health insurance ran out.
Okay, but I don't really get that, because he can obviously afford to spend $300 on her health insurance without them having to get married. Well, and that's one thing, like, not that this bitch owes us one thing. She has, her entire career has been a public service as far as I'm concerned. But like, I would have been interested to hear her write about making that jump in class from being like working class starving artist to, I assume, moving into an apartment in New York that her husband owns, having a house upstate, et cetera, et cetera. Having healthcare, you know?
Having all of your basic needs taken care of. Yeah.
Yeah.
So jumping back to when she meets Ad Rock, they're on an Australian tour that they were invited by Sonic Youth, right?
It was like some bill that, yeah, Sonic Youth was also on.
So Tamara Davis, who's married to Mike D, or I'm looking on Google, was married to Mike D, is Kathleen's entry point into the Beastie Boys. And so Kathleen Hanna's on a bill that the Beastie Boys are also on. They're on an Australian tour, and the two of them fall in love with each other secretly because Adam Horowitz is still married to Ione Skye.
It's truly the perfect Gen X love triangle.
That only you and I would care about.
Not you and I. Many people care about this.
And just the L word tree of everyone that these people have dated, like Anthony Kiedis documents extensively in his book Scar Tissue, which if I were him, I would pull from bookstores, how he dated Ione Skye when she was 15.
Yeah, so fucked up. And then she has a biography coming out.
Does she? Oh, yeah. I can't wait to read that. And Ione Skye is now married to Ben Lee, who is an Australian musician in his own right. But I remember him as Claire Danes' teenage boyfriend.
Yeah, of course. These are all legends. These are all legends.
So Kathleen and Adam fall in love, but they haven't even held hands. Aw.
And then after the tour, she's like obsessed with him. So she goes to like Sam Goody or something and buys a Beastie Boys poster and then literally like makes out with it like a little girl.
she goes to Sam Goody because she knows that no one that knows her would shop at a Sam Goody's because she doesn't want to be caught buying a Beastie Boys record, let alone a magazine. But to talk about the financial insecurity, she does note that, like, I can't even afford the magazines that I'm in at the time.
Yeah.
Anyway, they get married, and then you're right, there is a drop-off. Like, she does talk about her financial insecurity for so long, and then it kind of drops off when her and Adam Horowitz get together.
Yeah, and thank God, because she had been doing a combination of being in Bikini Kill and stripping since college, basically.
Oh, God, yeah, that is a very fucked up part of the book, amongst many fucked up parts of the book, where she's recording in D.C., and to supplement her income, she's stripping, but then there is this moment where her clients figure out that she's Kathleen Hanna and not her stripper name, Sage.
Yeah, because she was fully famous when she was stripping. I don't think a lot of people realize that, or famous to a certain subset of people that care about that kind of music.
Yeah, imagine being in music magazines, but then also having to strip for Diplomats.
Yeah, and then dumb hipsters would come in and put Smells Like Teen Spirit on the jukebox, and she'd have to strip to it. That shit is so fucked up.
What are other parts of the book I loved? I love the anecdote where she talks about seeing the Spice Girls on TV for the first time and being jealous of one of their girl power sequence leotards.
Yes, because Girl Power was the name of her very famous zine, and that did influence the Spice Girls somehow.
Some cool British producer, like, through osmosis, it ended up with the Spice Girls.
Also, can we talk about the fact that she has a secret child?
So yes, as two people who are fans of Kathleen Hanna, we knew she had a child, but could not figure out when that happened exactly. And it was basically 12 years ago.
Yeah, she's been hiding this child for over a decade?
More shocking, she's been hiding the fact that she has lived in Pasadena. Chelsea, do you know how close we've been to Kathleen Hanna and not even known it?
I know. She lives in like some fab mid-century house. I saw little bits of it photographed for the New York Times when they profiled her for this book.
And something that is documented in the documentary, the punk singer, is her struggle with Lyme disease. But the fucked up part in the book, she talks about when they finally diagnose it and she's given the right medication for it, she starts having seizures. And so she calls the doctor and it's like, obviously something is very wrong. I'm having seizures. And the doctor's like, no, that's actually the medicine working. You're just going to keep having seizures until the Lyme is out.
Yeah, that whole period seemed very dark, but there wasn't really a lot about it in this book. It went from childhood to the, I think, 7 or 8 years that she was in Bikini Kill. And then Le Tigre was just a blip, really.
Yeah, there was more time spent on falling in love with Adam Horowitz.
There was more time spent on Jewelry Ruin, which was basically her solo project that came in the middle of those two bands.
Right. There's like a little bit of mention of what life was like post Bikini Kill and Le Tigre going on tour in like the late 2010s, like 2018, 2019. Because we saw Bikini Kill in 2019.
Yeah, we did. That was amazing. And I went to one of the Le Tigre shows pretty recently also. I will always be so grateful to Kathleen Hanna, truly.
Absolutely. But there's a line in the book where she talks about like, oh, all my years of Lyme disease kind of being hidden away. And then during COVID. And that just made me realize like, oh, COVID must have been a nightmare for her as someone with a chronic illness.
Oh, I'm sure.
None of that is in the book, though. The book just sort of
literally just ends. Anyway, if you are a fan, read this book. But, you know, big trigger warning for this one.
Or you can buy the book digitally and then just search like for Adam Horowitz and just start the book there. You will have missed a lot of her life and a lot of good writing, but you will have evaded all of the sexual assault.
Yes. Anyway, go off, queen. We love you.
See you in August when you're playing the Wiltern.
Yes.
And last but certainly not least, a documentary that has been living rent-free, at least in my head, since I watched it over the weekend. Andrew McCarthy's Bratz documentary.
Not to be confused with Charlie XCX's Brat album. What are the odds that these two things happened at the same time?
And Paul is reading a book called Brat as well.
It's so wild because it's like Andrew McCarthy could never get over being offended by the term brat, whereas Charlie XCX like fully embraces it and uses it in an empowering way.
Yeah. So before I watched the documentary, I had seen people calling it a therapy session for Andrew McCarthy. And I was like, wow, that's really ungenerous. But like, no, that's absolutely what this is. So for those who have not seen the documentary, as a viewer, you might imagine it's a documentary about those actors who are in the Brat Pack told from someone who was inside said pack. But really, it is, you are correct, Chelsea, Andrew McCarthy being pissed off at a New York Magazine article from 40 years ago that he feels, in not so many words, derailed his career.
Yeah.
And he doesn't even read segments from the article, which is the craziest thing.
Well, also, okay, we should mention the article was written by David Blum for New York Magazine. He was 29 at the time that he wrote this. It chronicles his night out with, who all was there? Emilio Estevez, Judd Nelson.
Right. It's a profile about Emilio Estevez, who foolishly thought this journalist was his friend, and instead of just conducting it over coffee at the Chateau Marmont, brings this man out over several nights to party with him with Judd Nelson and Rob Lowe.
Okay, but I don't even think like the article is that bad. Like, they all seem pretty cool to me. Also, Andrew McCarthy is barely mentioned in this article. That's what I really don't understand.
The part of the article that mentions the Brat Pack, I too was like, this isn't that bad. This is the Hollywood Brat Pack. It is to the 80s what the Rat Pack was to the 1960s, a roving band of famous young stars on the prowl for parties, women, and a good time.
And what's wrong with that? Also, it was shocking to me reading the article and realizing that many people that are like classic Brat Pack people not mentioned in this article at all. And a lot of people that are identified as members of the Brat Pack, like Sean Penn, Tom Cruise, like
Matthew Modine.
Yeah, it's like, what? Also, Timothy Hutton.
The only time Andrew McCarthy is referenced in this article is a quote that someone within the Brat Pack says about him. He plays all his roles with too much of the same intensity. I don't think he'll make it. And you know what? I love Andrew McCarthy. I have seen Weekend at Bernie's 2 more times than I would like to say. He does bring the same intensity to every role. And David Blum did a follow-up article in New York Magazine that came out a few weeks ago where he basically just says, oh, Emilio Estevez is the one who said this about Andrew McCarthy.
Right. Yeah, that didn't surprise me. Also, he's interviewed. David Blum is interviewed, or rather just grilled and assaulted by Andrew McCarthy in this movie. And he's like, I completely defend what I wrote. I think they took this way too personally.
Who is the they? Because as you learn in this documentary, it's basically Andrew McCarthy who took it too seriously. And instead of fun anecdotes from making these movies that have stood the test of time, it's him trying to trauma bond with his former castmates, and no one is agreeing with him.
Well, that's not entirely true. Okay, let's talk about the Brat Pack from most traumatized to least traumatized, because Emilio Estevez seemed quite traumatized by the article.
Yes. The fallout, as you learn as a viewer, was basically, instead of the actors that are actually mentioned in this article, like a Matthew Modine, like a Nicolas Cage, these actors that were basically either in St. Elmo's Fire or The Breakfast Club were cautioned to not act with each other in movies because that would somehow dilute their acting careers.
Look, there was just a point where people got over the John Hughes movies and then they stopped getting great parts. But again, that didn't seem to hinder many other people's careers that are mentioned in this article.
Also, the structure of the document.
He believed his projection. To bring it back to Lord, did this derail your career because it changed the way that you think about yourself?
Well, I was about to say the structure of the documentary is so funny because he starts with Emilio and it's literally 45 seconds where Emilio is like, yeah, man, that sucked. Anyway, oh, yeah, we were supposed to do a film together and then I didn't. Bye. The most telling interview that he does is with Demi Moore, where she essentially says that to him, which is the experience is the experience. It's what you make of it. And in so many words, she's like, you made a lot out of it.
Yeah. But I think it's different for Demi Moore because the peak of her career came after that article, after being part of the Brat Pack, you know, I think about her as one of the ultimate 90s movie stars.
Right, but kind of after Emilio Estevez, he goes from person to person, whether it's John Cryer or Lauren Shuler Donner, who was the producer of St. Elmo's Fire and The Breakfast Club. And like, John Cryer is essentially like, I would have loved to have been considered in the Brat Pack. And Andrew McCarthy's like, all right. And then Lauren Shuler Donner, he's like, wasn't that fucked up that they called us the Brat Pack right before St. Elmo's Fire came out? And she was like, no, I thought it was brilliant. It differentiated you from the other actors.
Absolutely. It's brilliant marketing for them. But also Rob Lowe, not traumatized at all, similarly to Demi Moore. He's like, oh, I love that shit.
He loved it so much that it's in the trailer for the documentary. He's like, Andrew McCarthy's like, well, it's not like we were the Beatles. And he's like, I don't know, 1985? Kind of were.
Right. Could have sold out Shea Stadium.
Yeah. And I agree with that.
Absolutely. Well, also, it's like Rob Lowe. Fuck, Rob Lowe's hot. He's always going to be hot to me. He's just such a heartthrob. But also, he's the only person that gave me like what I truly wanted most from this documentary, which was crazy stories about them partying. He tells this story about how they went to Spago and ran into Liza Minnelli, and Liza Minnelli invited them over to Sammy Davis Jr.'s house. That's insane, but we don't get any other stories like that that really speak to their access and privilege and fame level during that time.
And the only other behind-the-scenes story we really get is this anecdote that Ally Sheedy talks about, or Andrew McCarthy and Ally Sheedy are talking about right before they shot, what would it have been? St. Elmo's Fire, where she's driving him down Sunset in her old Jeep.
Yeah, so it's like, okay, he drove on the Sunset Strip with Ally Sheedy once. That's literally all we get from this movie. Although, that said, I loved this. Like, I could watch this forever. I hope that this creates a new genre of documentary, which is just famous people looking back on something from the past that they were all involved in.
I mean, that does exist, but it's just podcasts now where former co-stars get together and discuss their old episodes.
See, I do think it would be cool if they had all been together like The Breakfast Club, which, you know, Brett Easton Ellis referred to as a therapy jam. And that's so true. Some of the most satisfying parts of Bratz, I thought, were actually Bret Easton Ellis's commentary and Malcolm Gladwell's commentary.
That was crazy. Like, Andrew McCarthy's really trying to drill down on something that's not that serious. And he goes...
yeah, really. It's so not that deep. That's basically what Rob Lowe and Demi Moore were trying to tell him.
But in order to try to understand why they were all labeled with being Brat Packers, he goes to Malcolm Gladwell. And even Malcolm Gladwell's like, I fucking love the Brat Pack.
Yeah, but I love how he's like, I was Team Ducky.
And Andrew McCarthy's like, why?
Yeah, he was like legitimately offended.
So there are two people that are not present in this documentary, and it's Molly Ringwald and Judd Nelson. And I feel like them declining to participate seems to be a cosign that Andrew McCarthy is a bad hang.
Well, okay. We never know what's up with Judd Nelson, because, like, remember how they did the Breakfast Club thing at the Oscars, and it did seem as if he had come straight from a cabin in the woods.
Oh, yeah. No, the headline, instead of, like, a moving tribute to John Hughes, was like, what is wrong with Judd Nelson?
So Judd Nelson's, like, on his own backwoods journey, potentially. Molly Ringwald, that's interesting.
The reasoning that's given in the documentary is not that Andrew McCarthy is a bad hang, but instead that she just doesn't want to look back. She just wants to look forward.
Yeah, to be fair, having to talk about this with Andrew McCarthy on camera for like an hour or two does sound emotionally taxing.
It's weird, too, because it's not like Andrew McCarthy has, sorry, Judd Nelson, but Judd Nelson's career. He's written best-selling books. He's a TV director now. He has a successful career in that.
Yeah.
Like, everything worked out.
Look, everything did work out, but it's crazy after watching this film, even I think the act of him making this film and revisiting all this stuff, like, I don't think it helped him at all.
Absolutely, you know what I mean? Not.
It's like he's still, like, so fucked up about it.
And unlike, to go back to the Lord and Charlie XCX song, like, I don't think this documentary helped reignite any of those friendships. That's the other crazy thing that he keeps saying in the documentary. why did we all get lumped together? We weren't even friends with each other.
It's like, don't tell me that. Don't ruin the illusion for me.
Yeah, like, I'm not going to tell our listeners that you and I are not actually friends at all. We only get together for this podcast.
Yeah, it is sad hearing that. But clearly, that's not entirely true, because they were all hanging out together at these various points. I get that maybe they didn't all go out together like Molly, Allie, you know, the whole crew, but...
Some of them paired off.
Clearly they did. No need to lie about it. Also, clearly some of them fucked, and I want to know more about that.
Well, I mean, Emilio Estevez and Demi Moore were engaged at one point.
I think some more tea could have been spilled. I want a little more sex and drugs. Like, come on. It's been so long. Who the fuck cares? I don't know why people are so guarded in documentaries where people talk about shit that happened like 30 years ago.
Sometimes the messenger is too close to the subject. Like, this documentary reminded me of the NXIVM documentary I think HBO did a few years ago, where it was like members within NXIVM, where it's like, oh, you're way too close to this because I've watched three parts of Keith Raniere playing volleyball. Like, that's not what I want from this documentary. Tell me about the branding. I'm saying that maybe this documentary would have been more successful if someone who wasn't Andrew McCarthy.
No, but that's what makes it so special. Like, he's unhinged, but like, I actually like that it is so personal. I don't need the Bratz documentary to be like unbiased.
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, like, maybe the better messenger would have been Rob Lowe.
That would have been a very different movie. Anywho.
Well, that about does it. We still don't have an ending for this show.
Oh, great. I love the part of the show where we can't figure out how to end the show. How fun for our listeners.
You know what, Chell? There's only one solution. We never end the show.
No, we have to end the show. And, you know, if I'm going to take anything from this episode, is that we should all have the generosity and the self-awareness of Lorde and the optimism of Rob Lowe.
Wow. Deep.
Anyway, we love you guys. Bye.
Bye.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.